Coming up on the program, free trade and the NAFTA effect. The business of taking brand new electronics apart. And more music festivals than bands know what to do with. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 7th day of May today. The President of the United States is going to be in Oregon tomorrow at Nike headquarters. He may or may not pick up some new gear while he's out there. I don't know. But what he's actually going out to do is some free trade politics. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership is deep in negotiations, as you know. There's also another trade deal, this one with Europe, being worked on hot on its heels. But the debate around those two has dredged up memories of a much older discussion about the North American Free Trade Agreement. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going with NAFTA in the age of the TPP.
Andy Scheuer has a T-shirt that lists NAFTA negotiation sessions on the back like their concert tour dates, a memento from when he was a lawyer spending late nights typing drafts of the deal. He's now a partner at the law firm Sidley Austin.
My wife remarked that while it was safe to wear that in the house, it probably was prudent to wear that around the neighborhood.
It was mostly a joke, but it shows how divisive NAFTA's become.
People seem to know that NAFTA should be opposed without really understanding why.
There will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Now, Ross Perot is not a name that comes up a lot these days, but this line from a 1992 presidential debate is often cited to sum up public fears about how NAFTA would send jobs to Mexico. What it actually did?
So NAFTA did not do as much as is claimed by people who are either for or against NAFTA.
Simon Johnson is a professor of global economics at MIT.
It did increase trade, particularly between Mexico and the United States. It did displace some jobs in the United States, and some people who lost those jobs didn't get good jobs again.
Trade has winners and losers. Many labor unions, for example, will say the losses aren't worth the gains. Lots of economists disagree, including Jeffrey Schott with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. But he says politicians often try and sell these deals by promising new jobs.
People with an economics 101 background know pretty well that you're not going to create more jobs through a trade agreement, but trade agreements affect the type of jobs available in an economy.
Ideally, jobs with higher wages. Fast forward to today, as critics call the Trans-Pacific Partnership NAFTA on steroids, and President Obama argues it should be debated on its merits, not what NAFTA did or didn't do. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Whole Foods, the pricey upscale grocery store, or the upscale pricey grocery store, take your pick, is branching out a bit to a new kind of store. We don't know all that much about it yet, other than it's going to be smaller, cheaper, and aimed at millennials. The backdrop here is that Whole Foods has seen its once booming sales slow as more traditional supermarkets have started to offer organic and otherwise healthy foods. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons reports on what a Whole Foods for millennials might look like.
We already have an idea of what it might be named. Whole Foods registered a few trademarks preemptively: Daily Shop, Small Batch, Swift Goods, and some others. If those names sound quick and easy to you, perhaps it's no accident. Darren Seifer, a food and beverage analyst at the NPD Group, says millennials eat out less than previous generations. So even though they're cooking at home,
they were trying still to replicate some of the properties that restaurants provided them.
Those properties, he says, are speed, quality, and freshness. Sounds like millennials would be ideal Whole Foods customers, right? Except for one big problem.
You know, everyone likes to call them whole paycheck.
Whole Foods is really expensive, and the millennial generation eats out less not only because it's healthier, but because they are poorer. Economists say the recession created permanent damage to this generation's earning capacity. Whole Foods' model of organic and fresh at high prices has been undercut by places like Walmart and Target, which have begun to offer organic options for less money, says Mark Wiltemuth, managing director at Jefferies.
This will be a way for them to kind of reach that new broadening out of the organics demand that is going on in the marketplace.
Christina Rack is a senior analyst at Huge. She says it's a tightrope walk when a high-end retailer tries to enter a lower-priced market.
maintaining the integrity of the brand while doing so in a way that makes it appeal to a broader audience will be most important.
So maybe this new one will still be regarded as fancy, but just a little bit less expensive. Half paycheck, anyone? In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Little bumpy at the open on Wall Street today, then a climb into the close. Maybe everybody's getting excited for Jobs Day tomorrow. I know I am. We'll have the details. I am, really, when we do the numbers. There's a story in the New York Times today, which is, on the face of it, a story about manicures and pedicures, but which turns out to be a pulling back of the curtain on a slice of the economy that has kind of been hiding in plain sight. It's a story about stolen wages and worker mistreatment and the role the rest of us have in that economy. It's called The Price of Nice Nails. Sarah Maslin Neer wrote it. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is an amazing story. How did you come to it?
I actually came to it a very unusual way. I was getting a pedicure at a quirky salon that's 24 hours in Koreatown in New York City. And I started talking to the woman and who was doing my toes. And she said to me, you know, I work the day shift. It's a 24-hour salon. And I said, oh, well, who works the night shift? And she said, oh, I work the night shift. And I said, but it's the daytime. What do you mean? And she said, I sleep in a barracks above the salon. When a person comes in the evening, they shake me awake and I do a treatment. I work 6 days a week, 24 hours a day. And on the seventh day, I go back to my bedsit apartment in Flushing and I sleep for 24 hours and come right back. And I just thought, this woman is enslaved.
Not only are they kept in these terrible conditions, really, but they're basically not paid. I mean, they have to pay a fee to get trained to begin with, and then they work without pay for months and months and months.
So the protagonist of the story, Jing Ren, a young Chinese girl, she paid $100 to work at a salon. And then she ended up working, as all of them do, almost all of them, for free for a period of weeks or up to a month. Hers was almost 3 months. And at an arbitrary point in that, the owner decided that she was good enough to merit being paid. And then she found out her salary would be $30 a day.
How much of this is related to the price that is charged for the services, which in New York, as you say, is pretty low?
So I did a survey of 105 salons in New York City and found the average price to be about $10 for a manicure. The countrywide average, according to Nails Magazine, an industry publication, is $22. So why, in the most expensive city in the United States, where a latte costs $4, is a manicure the cheapest of anywhere? And something I keep coming to again and again, the manicure industry predicates itself on the idea of a discount luxury. And there is no such thing. And as experts have told me, someone is bearing the cost of your discount. And in this case, it's always the worker.
You went to salon owners, you went to the trade associations and said, what gives? What was their answer?
Actually, a sort of funny interview with the trade association, the Korean American Nail Salon Association. My translator, Jiha Ham, called him up to set up an interview with me. And he said to Jiha, on the record, I don't want to meet with Ms. Neer. I can't have an interview with her. I won't say anything because too many of the owners pay below minimum wage for me to say anything. It'll harm the industry.
Wow.
They all know what's going on because that's the business model.
They do say, though, the owners, that they believe, in essence, they're doing a good thing. They're helping these immigrants, they're almost all immigrants, get that first rung up on the American dream.
Sure. They believe themselves to be heroic. Many of these workers come here with huge debts to snakeheads who brought them from China or coyotes who brought them from various countries like Ecuador. And they're desperate for work. And the owners of salons feel that they're providing them that money they desperately need. But is it right to take advantage of a person in desperation?
There is a hierarchy as well within. Not only is there the owner-employee hierarchy, but within the salons themselves, who does which job is very much rank-ordered.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's so wild, there are three jobs in the salon, sort of an expert, a middle person, and the newbie. But even within that, how much you get paid and what jobs you're assigned are based on your race or ethnicity. The Koreans, particularly young and beautiful women, are paid the most. following them are Chinese, and below them are Hispanic women or men and other races. And then I met workers, Hispanic workers in a Korean salon, who only they were not allowed to speak a word for a 12-hour shift while the Korean women could chat freely, or workers who had to eat in the basement because their food was considered smelly where the Korean woman could eat at their desk, and just this systemic race-based abuse and lack of compensation.
It's a piece in the New York Times today called The Price of Nice Nails. Part two drops tomorrow. The reporter on it, and it's an extraordinary story, is Sarah Maslin Neer. Sarah, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
It's so good for an up-and-coming band because when we go to a new territory, we don't have to have the pressure of filling the club all by ourselves.
More music festivals than you can shake a stick at. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 82 points today, 0.4%, ended things at 17,924. The NASDAQ added 25 points, about 0.5%, finished at 49.45. The S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.3%. Closed at 2,088. The Wall Street Journal reports that Yelp is looking for a buyer and shares of the online review site shot up 23%. They are, however, still less than half of Yelp's all-time high of a year ago. Keurig Green Mountain ground down 9% today after lowering its forecast for the year. The coffee maker left a bitter taste with its latest brewing system. Doesn't work with non-Keurig pods, which means you will, when you add up all those Keurig pods, pay $50 a pound for your coffee. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its April jobs report. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for March. And it's 129 years old. Coca-Cola traces its roots back to May 8, 1886, when pharmacist John Pemberton invented the syrup for the carbonated beverage. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I saw kind of an amazing video online the other day on a website called iFixit. Somebody taking a brand new Apple Watch and taking it apart.
Peeking underneath the display, we see we'll need to disconnect the display and digitizer cables, which are trapped underneath the springy bracket, not unlike the Touch ID cable we saw in the iPhone 5S.
All the way apart.
Moving right along, we take out the antenna assembly, the button cable with a mechanical button, and a button cover that looks exactly like what you would find in an iPhone, only this one, like everything else in this watch, is tiny.
While interesting in a kind of voyeuristic way, one is left to wonder why somebody would take apart a perfectly good $349 piece of hardware. So we got Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the line to get some answers. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
So what the heck with these videos, man? It's crazy.
Teardowns don't just happen in awkward boardroom meetings, Kai. They happen all over the internet. They're huge.
I found
almost a million of them on YouTube. People are tearing open these devices as soon as they come out and trying to repair them with weird tools like a nail file looking thing called a spudger.
Okay, so what's the larger purpose here then?
So the larger purpose is to actually help people understand not only how their devices work, but how you can fix them, right? And you might know this, Kai. You don't actually get that from the company when they give you the new device.
Right.
You don't get a manual. You don't get instructions for fixing it, which is kind of interesting because there's this whole economy that's sprung up around repair shops and companies that actually write manuals for these devices.
No, that's totally true. I mean, I've now dropped my iPad 3 times. I've got an iPad guy, and it's easier and faster than going to the Apple store, honestly.
And often cheaper, right?
Yeah.
Think of it like, I guess, you know, when you buy a car, perhaps you might take it to the actual dealership to get it repaired, and that might cost you 20, 30% more than it would cost you to go around the corner to the guy who's got the chop shop or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I think this is really interesting. So I talked to the guy from iFixit, and his name is Kyle Weens. He told me we're in this kind of device repair shop renaissance.
There has been a huge growth in local cell phone and electronics repair shops. Our estimates are that there's between 5 and 10,000 new phone repair shops in the U.S. just in the last several years.
Makes sense.
It makes total sense, and it's a huge change. Now, we should note that these companies that make these devices, they don't actually provide the information of how to fix this stuff. Part of that is just it doesn't seem to be worth it for these companies to a certain degree. I mean, they will fix it for you if you bring it into the Apple store or you send it back to Google or whatever. But, you know, they it's just not worth it. And they're going to ask you to buy the next device next year.
I was just going to say, they're going to have the new Apple Watch is coming out, I'm sure, in 18 months, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And they're gonna want you to buy that one.
Right.
So, and throw out the other one.
Right. Yeah. So iFixit is really providing a service to this economy.
They really are.
Yeah.
But what's a little bit scary to think about, though, Kai, is that also what happens here is after a boom, right? What comes after a boom?
Bust.
There
you go.
Bust. The CEO of iFixit also mentioned the fact that that bust could be coming.
The repair industry tends to be boom bust. For a long time, there were TV repair techs in every neighborhood in America back in the 70s and 80s. They all went out of business, and then there were local camera repair shops.
Right,
so
right,
now
right.
You've got cell phone repair shops springing up. It's amazingly cyclical.
And if you go to this guy's website, Kai, there's actually a prompt to go and support a bill that was introduced in New York State that would require manufacturers to give third-party repair folks more information about how to repair these devices. So it's interesting.
The Teardown Economy with Ben Johnson. He's the host of Marketplace Tech. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Kai.
There was Coachella last month. Sasquatch is coming up in a couple of weeks. Bonnaroo this summer. And I can't even tell you how many more besides. The number of multi-day music festivals has gone from a handful to hundreds more, maybe, than the music industry can actually handle. Jessica Robinson reports.
Forget shows and clubs and concert halls. Summer tours for some bands are now a matter of hopping from one grassy lawn to another. Take the indie rock band Modest Mouse. If you miss them at Sasquatch over Memorial Day weekend, you can catch them later this summer at the Sloss Music Festival in Birmingham, Alabama, at Celebrate Brooklyn, or at the Forecastle Festival in Louisville, Music Fest Northwest in Portland, and you get the idea.
We do live in a culture right now that is heavily saturated with festivals.
Jonathan Levine is a talent agent in Nashville.
And that if somebody has a plot of land and a checkbook, they can suddenly find themselves in the festival business.
Levine's roster includes the Black Eyed Peas and the Grateful Dead, who, of course, played one of the most iconic music festivals. But a lot has changed since Woodstock. Music festivals have gone mainstream, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars. Millennials, it seems, are willing to shell out for multi-day music experiences, and deep-pocketed corporate sponsors are willing to shell out to reach them. And it's all come none too soon for musicians. Caitlin and Lori Shook are in Spokane, Washington for a show. The two lithe blondes are the front women of the Shook Twins, a Portland, Oregon-based indie folk pop group. The room is packed, but this is actually the group's downtime before festival season.
Just been sitting around.
We're saving up our vegetative state.
Yes.
So we can just keep going nonstop all summer.
Yeah.
The growth in the number of music festivals over the last decade and a half has coincided with a big shift in how people buy recorded music, if they buy it. And now streaming services like Spotify, Pandora, and soon Apple Beats are reinventing the model again.
The whole industry, the whole scenario of all of it is changing so much, especially with internet and, you know, downloads and MP3s and stuff. So the festivals are really where it's at.
Music festivals, by comparison, seem relatively easy.
It's so good for an up-and-coming band because they don't. When we go to a new territory, we don't have to have the pressure of filling the club all by ourselves. We're part of this huge thing that they're promoting it and they're doing all the cool stuff for it.
Both up-and-coming artists and some big-name headlining bands now plan their tours around festivals. But is there a ceiling on all this growth?
The problem that we've got is that everyone is really competing for the same pool of talent, and it's not just in North America, it's worldwide.
Gary Bongiovanni is the editor of the concert business trade publication Polestar. He says in early April, Blues Fest in Australia had Ben Harper, Hozier, David Gray, Counting Crows, and a lot of other in-demand acts. That meant they couldn't be in the U.S. for the ever-increasing number of festivals here. Bongiovanni predicts a bloody market correction that weeds out weaker festivals. And he's not the only one making gloomy predictions.
There's only so many artists that can play and anchor and headline the festivals.
That's music agent Jonathan Levine again.
So it's going to be a little bit of survival of the fittest. Some will thrive and others will not.
He says larger festivals have come up with an interesting way to make sure they have exclusive rights on the headliners. It's called a radius clause. That's when, say, the Bonnaroo Festival in Tennessee tells a band they can't play within 300 miles of the festival 2 months before or after. All of this isn't bothering Drew Lorona too much. He's one of the founders of the fledgling Treefort Music Festival in Boise, Idaho. Like most new festivals, it's struggled to turn a profit. But Lorona says the Urban Music Festival has been careful to grow slowly, and it put its emphasis on discovering unknown bands.
I think the festivals that will struggle are going to be the ones that don't have that differentiation. And that seems to be what's popping up the most, is the kind of branded as like a party in the desert type of thing.
And speaking of popping up, he knows of at least two new music festivals starting in Idaho this summer. I'm Jessica Robinson for Marketplace.
The Walt Disney Company reported earnings a couple of days ago. Did quite fine, thank you very much. Net income up about 10%. A bit more than $500 million worth of Disney's profits came from its parks and resorts, the digital modernization of which is the subject of a new article in Fast Company magazine. It's titled The Messy Business of Reinventing Happiness, and it's about a Disney plan called My Magic Plus. Austin Carr has the byline. Austin, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
A definition of terms, I think, is probably in order here. My Magic Plus. What is this whole thing?
My Magic Plus is basically this massive project that Disney undertook for the last 6 or 7 years to remake its entire Walt Disney World park with a digital and technological layer. And basically what that means is they added what's called a magic band to get around the park. That's this electronic wristband that allows you to essentially interact with everything at Walt Disney World, whether that's entering the park, paying for goods at restaurants, unlocking your hotel room. It's essentially this virtual key to the Magic Kingdom. And My Magic Plus is sort of the infrastructure that they put in place to allow these digital interactions.
The thing that is interesting to me about this story is that it's a legacy company, among the oldest of the old line entertainment companies in this country, being dragged, as you lay out in this article, almost kicking and screaming into the digital age.
Right, right. And I think the issue is that it's not just a company filled with legacy, but it's a company filled with tradition. I mean, this is sort of a blueprint that Walt Disney himself laid out. And you can imagine, I'm not sure if you're a big fan of Disney and Walt Disney World.
I've got kids. I've been to Disneyland. I mean, yeah.
Exactly. And so you know sort of the emotions that go into creating an experience that kids not only love, but adults look back fondly on as well. And so it's not only trying to preserve that traditional experience, but also making sure it lasts for the next century.
The board decides to spend $1 billion on this. They don't necessarily have buy-in from other parts of the company, specifically one group, which is basically the custodian of the memories of Walt Disney, if you will. Right, the Imagineers.
Right. The Walt Disney Imagineers, I mean, these are the guys that Walt tasked with essentially being the creative minds behind the in-park guest experience. The Imagineers wholeheartedly believe that these children and even adults are going to get swept away in their imaginations and really become a part of the movies that they're used to seeing on screen. So having a iPhone or having a magic band, this sort of electronic wristband that might disrupt the experience, is just sort of a no-go for them. I mean, that's what they were sort of hesitant about doing. And the Imagineers, at least based on my reporting, were one of the groups that had differences of opinion, shall we say, in how to deliver this thing.
The parks are, and you say this in the piece, it all becomes sort of a virtuous circle of brand consumption, right? If the parks work, then the movies work. If the movies work, then the characters work. If the characters work, then the parks work. And it all feeds off itself, which is why this thing was so critical.
Right. You know, if you go to the park, you see this ride and it's related to Dumbo. I mean, that's a movie that's decades old, and yet they're still deriving benefit from it within the park. And that's because kids are still buying the DVD, which is not cheap, mind you. And so that's the type of revenue and revenue regeneration that the company can rely on. And they want to keep that park as sort of that core virtuous cycle of this sort of, you know, brand affinity and brand love.
You strapped one of these things on and you used it. What was the experience like for you?
Yeah, I do really love it. You know, obviously, I know the Apple Watch just came out, and having used this sort of magic band, the sort of killer app for me, if you will, is payments. I mean, just having to leave my hotel room without worrying if I have my wallet, without worrying if I have my cell phone, and being able to buy, you know, a cup of coffee at Starbucks in Disney World is pretty awesome.
Austin Carr is a senior writer at Fast Company. His piece about Disney and the Magic Band is called The Messy Business of Reinventing Happiness. Austin, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, a pretty clear illustration of the problems that McDonald's is going to have turning itself around, as the company said earlier this week it very much wants to do. This ad, and I need you to imagine a nice up-close shot of a big, juicy Big Mac here, aired about 4, maybe 5 months ago.
All vegetarians, foodies, and gastronauts, kindly avert your eyes. You can't get juiciness like this from soy or quinoa. This is not Greek yogurt. Nor will that ever be kale.
Well, it might be. You know where this is going, right? Mickey D's is indeed going to go with kale. They are testing 2 breakfast bowls here in Southern California, one of which will have kale in it. Just count yourself lucky you don't live here, people. You know what are really good, though? Just full disclosure here. Kale chips. Really tasty. The Dow up 82 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ added 25 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.3%. Golda Arthur, Kate Concannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And oh yeah, this is APM.